Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley and I'm joined tonight for a discussion of my five favorite movies by my two friends, Doug.
Please, call me LeBet.
And JB.
Call me Buzzkill.
I don't want to do the whole... You do the speech about F This Movie.
Please, refer to me as LeBet.
LeBet, can you do the speech about F This
Find
Movie?
Find us on the iTunes Store.
It's becoming something different. It's becoming...
It's already
Italian?
Yeah.
Wait a minute, why are Doug's hands smoking?
He just killed someone.
Why is Doug smoking?
Bell. He has a bad nicotine habit. I just had sex with LaBelle.
You can find us, our website...
What, smoking?
At This Movie. Guys, don't spoil the fact that The Mask is my number four favorite movie. You can find us at fthismovie.blogspot.com. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. On Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. You can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Or you can find us in iTunes, and we're asking if it's at all possible, if you guys find us on iTunes and you listen to it and you like our show, maybe write a review of us or just click on the little star rating at the bottom and give us as many stars as you can
or as you would like. Only five stars are being accepted, so
yes.
Just go with that.
Go with the five.
And for those of you paying attention, I think we've just established what the... illustration will be at the header of this podcast.
Perhaps. We don't know where this is going to go. We're finally finishing this favorite movies series, which seems like it started 2 years ago.
Finally. Yawn.
Yeah. It seemed like a great idea at the time, and now it's my turn. I'm like
so many things.
Do it. Yeah. But before we talk about my dumb favorite movies...
They're not all dumb.
Have you boys seen any good movies lately?
I saw Tango and Cash
for the
first time
in
Patrick's basement.
Yeah, you did.
It wasn't against my will. It was very
like
much...
so many film screenings in Patrick's basement.
It was. I feel almost embarrassed to admit that I in my 30s and I have not seen Tango and Cash, even though I know a lot of the jokes.
Nobody's nerfed.
And I know you wrote about it in your awesome new column, Heavy Action.
Thank you.
And I loved it, ironically.
Can you sing a little Heavy Action for us?
Ironically.
Right.
No, I can't. Heavy Action.
It's the NFL theme, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's the Monday Night Football theme.
Oh,
yeah,
okay,
I thought you meant like there's a theme that goes with your comment.
Oh, no, not at all.
Patrick writes nothing that is not a pun or a reference to something else.
Usually football.
Usually Monday Night Football. I saw it. It's great. It's so unbelievably of its time.
Yeah.
It's the lines, everything is... I mean, he wrote about it, a great column. Read it if you haven't already, just because he kind of says everything I would like to say about it. And honestly, I'm kind of mad that he didn't wait for me to give my two cents about
it.
It's really funny and just hilarious. And just I found myself at the end, the last, no joke, about 8 minutes of the movie, I caught myself, my mouth was open, and I was leaning forward in my chair like, what am I watching? It was unbelievable. So I watched that.
And it ends on that freeze frame high five, and you're like, all is right with the world!
It doesn't ever vary from, like, it sets a tone in the first 2 seconds with Sylvester Stallone's dialogue.
Yeah.
Over. I'm going to cut the chug over. And then they high five at the end, and it's perfect, and all is right, like you said.
I only saw that when it first came out. I've never seen it since. But I remember it being goofy fun.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Without the benefit of hindsight. I mean, I was watching it genuinely.
Well, it came out the same year as Lethal Weapon 2, and,
and
there's so much about that movie that I actually did some research. I was so curious about this movie. I did research, like the director was fired.
Yeah.
They brought in a different director.
Yeah.
The DP was Barry Sonnenfeld.
Yeah, he got
and
fired,
he was fired by Sylvester Stallone because Stallone didn't like the way he was lit.
Yeah.
The music is Harold Faltermeyer, who did Axel F. But he was also, like, when he was done. They had to come back and shoot the end scene, so they brought in a different... There's all these, like... It's just all over the place, and it comes together
look
in such
at how
a
it came
mess.
Together.
It's so great. It's so
like
wonderful.
A beautiful Frankenstein's monster.
A troubled production.
I also saw something else on Netflix. I don't think I want to say what it is, because I will be writing about it for the first installment of I'll Watch Anything, which will come out next week.
We're actually going to do that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Doug had to go first, and the gauntlet has been thrown down in a big, bad way.
It's going to be interesting what I actually write, because I don't know how to assemble vomit into words.
I can give you some pointers on that. This week was a great example of that. Did you honestly think I should watch An American President?
I like it.
Because I've never seen
it. I know, and I remembered you saying that, so I was trying to name movies that weren't all terrible.
Script by Sorkin, and
yeah.
It's worth a look.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's one of those movies I've seen probably 5 times, and it's definitely flawed, but it's so... I love it so much. There's and seriously, with like unironically, I think it's really sweet and charming.
And the sand line is from the movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Which, by the way, that sand line, I don't know if I even understand
it. I don't either, but it's Michael J. Fox.
It's Michael J. Fox saying Aaron Sorkin's words,
right.
So I will take
basically
it.
Basically playing George Stephanopoulos.
Yeah.
That was a movie that, like, when it started airing on TNT, they used to just show stuff back to back, like it's on at 7, and then it repeats at 9. I watched it both times.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty easy to watch, too.
Yeah. J-Bones, what have you seen?
Well, 2 quick things. I went to the Landmark Century yesterday and saw all of the nominated animated shorts.
Okay.
And all of the nominated live-action shorts.
Very yes. Cool.
And either I've lost my mind or they need to do a better job of advertising it. It turns out the documentary shorts were at the Music Box, a different theater on a different day. So how one theater chain got
right.
2/3 and why these don't come out to the suburbs, because what a marketing opportunity to get people to watch short films. One of them, and I'm going to butcher the title, The Fabulous Flying Books of Matthew Latimer, I think that's close enough to get you to it, is available for free on iTunes. And I don't know if that's like a rental or just a watch or if you're able to download it and keep it forever. It's so touching at the end. Everyone in the theater was crying.
Wow.
Wow.
And I think that's the one that should win, but I don't think it will, because one of its competitors is from the fine folks at Pixar, and it's very cute, and it's very charming. But The Fabulous Flying Books of Matthew Lattimore is about reading and people who read books and what books bring to your life. So it's a very literate crowd.
So it's kind of like an animated short of You've Got Mail. Where they talk, it's 2 bookstore owners.
Not in the least. I beg to differ.
But you liked all the shorts. I know we've done, you and I did
right,
that a couple
that
years
was
ago.
So much fun.
Yeah, it was great. I
but,
wish I was invited this year. I mean,
like
it sounds
it was,
like it was fun this year,
like
too.
Yeah,
did you have to work yesterday?
Possibly. On George Washington's birthday?
Yes, I did, actually.
That's what I went. And you could tell that the theater was full of teachers. It's great to see all the nominees. You're in this much better position come Oscar night. And I remember what I was going to say. The animated shorts are so short that to keep people from, like, rioting when the 5 nominees were over, there was a selection of commended films to get the combined running time up to 90 minutes. Although because they were in the same theater, and I mean literally on the same screen, 11:30, 1:30, you kind of bridled at having to pay twice.
Yeah.
And that's the reason they had it in the same theater.
Right.
So they could clear it.
Right, right, right.
Clear it
right.
And make sure that everyone was paying. Although
right.
You shouldn't rankle it paying for a film. And I'd like to make a case for another film that I saw a week or two ago and just thought was terrific. And little by little, my students are seeing it and they're coming back and they're saying that they loved it. The Woman in Black.
Hmm.
Old school. Suspense. A lot of good boobs, a story that actually makes sense.
I'm sorry,
sense.
Good boobs? I misheard
booze,
you.
B-O-O-Z-E.
Oh, I love
drinking.
Like small batch whiskeys.
No.
Micro booze?
What a ghost might say to you if he was trying to startle you.
Have some micro
pregnant.
Oh, I stepped on your joke. That's pretty good.
Sorry.
I haven't read any of the reviews. I went to see it not knowing anything about it, and it's just so well made and full of suspense. The score is by Marco Beltrami, who did the first Scream movie. And say what you want. It has an ending that you might disagree with and think is batshit, but they stick with the courage of their convictions. If you're sick of ghost movies that say, was there ghosts or not? You be the judge. This film doesn't do that at all. This film
There's
comes
totally
down on one
zero
side.
Ghosts.
This film comes down on one side and really has the courage of saying, oh no, that's how it ends. It's terrific. It's,
yeah.
It's my favorite horror film in a really long time.
Wow. All right. Cool.
What have you seen, Patrick?
Well, I saw a much worse film called This Means War.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
Listen, my wife and I wanted to go to a movie. There was not a whole lot out. We had not yet been recommended The Woman in Black, so we said,
you had already seen We Bought a Zoo.
It's coming out on DVD in April. I like Chris Pine. I like Tom Hardy. The trailers looked horrible, and they do not mislead you in the least. That's the movie. It defines hacky. I mean, it is just, it's such a movie. It's so terrible. Reese Witherspoon is not a person. She's just a tiny elf.
And it takes place in movie world?
Oh, does it ever? Every set is so designed in this. Everybody's apartment tells you everything about them. This guy lives
in a Crate and Barrel catalog.
Right. The kind of tougher Tom Hardy guy. He's kind of the, you know, Chris Pine is the pretty boy and Tom Hardy is like the quieter, tougher guy. And he just lives in like this wooden loft with motorcycles around.
I was going to say, he lives in Hitler's bunker.
Chris Pine lives like there's a swimming pool on his roof where women are swimming over his head. It's a ridiculous movie. Every scene that Reese Witherspoon has, the structure is so fascinating because, like, she'll go out on a date with one of the two guys. If you don't know what the movie's about, she's dating these two CIA operatives, and they both know it, and she doesn't, and it's a ridiculous
movie. Like Mad Magazine Spy versus Spy come to life
meets True Lies.
Which, when the film was first being marketed, my wife said, they should have gone with Spy versus Spy. Everybody knows what that is. What a marketing opportunity!
If you want to,
if the movie was good, and you, I mean, right. I have an affection towards Mad Magazine and Spy versus
Maybe
Spy.
Maybe they offered it to Mad Magazine. And Mad Magazine said no thanks. Not unless they wear the hats.
If you want to make a movie about
the lighter side of shitty movies
about Chris Pine and Tom Hardy being like spies, I'll see that movie. That's awesome. But don't have them date Reese Witherspoon. Every time she goes on a date, then it cuts to her on the phone, like, debriefing with Chelsea Handler, who is the enemy of all that is funny or good in the world. I did not like the movie.
And
I wouldn't have gathered that from your description.
That reminds me, when we were at the Landmark, they have this cubbyhole with all this film stuff that you can grab. And the Film Center of the Art Institute is honoring Reese Witherspoon in April with their Renaissance Film Person Award, and you can attend. Tickets start at $400.
To be in the same room as Reese Witherspoon?
Can you tickets start? I think that's behind a fence. Can you say fundraiser, Kitty?
Jeez. Well, listen, she was in Sweet Home Alabama.
She was in Twilight.
She was in Legally
Blonde. She has an Oscar.
Yes, she does. She's one of those. You were the best line. Movie star.
I prefer Reese without her spoon.
you sound like Mr. Skin. Also, Netflix Instant just added a bunch of like Roger Corman New World titles, and there's a bunch of good ones on there. I just recently, for the first time, saw Humanoids from the Deep.
The original version, because there's two. They remade that.
The original from 1980.
Where they went back and added...
Yeah.
That was sort of a famous case. The director was very upset. Added creature rape sequences.
Did they ever? Vic Morrow has like a perm. It's very strange.
That movie's a little too rapey for my taste. Lately I've been trying to introduce that as a new adjective.
Rapey.
It's not good, but I also saw Grand Theft Auto, which is the first movie that Ron Howard ever made. And maybe his best movie, and it's been all downhill ever since then? I don't know.
No, it's terrific fun, and I'm wondering if Netflix is adding those, because in a couple weeks, the Corman documentary...
Oh, yeah.
...that I never managed to see is coming out on DVD and Blu-ray, and... Everything I've seen, including the trailer, oh, God, it's so terrific.
Yeah.
They got an interview with Nicholson.
I'm excited about it.
And I guess he tells some stories.
About the trip? No, he wasn't affiliated with the trip.
No. I'm just saying.
About Roman Polanski?
that Nicholson's a raconteur and he's featured in the trailer. And
what do you think it would sound like if Nicholson told a story about Roger Corman?
Roger Corman, et cetera, et cetera.
Wait.
We have Rich Little on the podcast.
Is that
everyone?
Jack
a really big show.
Is that Jack Nicholson or the Beast?
Please call me Jack Nicholson. Call me Mr. Catpoop.
I actually heard something about Netflix. I guess the Weinstein Company is releasing their titles on Netflix before it will come out on DVD and Blu-ray.
Yeah, that's a big deal. The artist is coming out. Stupid Madonna.
But I think a lot of their stuff. I think this is their new. Really? Okay. I think this is. I don't know. Unless I misread the article.
Instead of going to cable, right? It's going to go to Netflix, or is it instead of DVD?
I think it's not instead, because it's going to come out on DVD eventually, right. But it's before.
Oh. In a weird way, I think it's smart, and we've talked about this, and I don't want to belabor the subject. There's people who like to collect physical objects, but that's
going away.
That's going the way of the Model T. You want to watch the movie?
What happened to the Model T?
Well, except for the 8 in your garage. He's got a big garage, ladies and gentlemen. And yes, that's a euphemism.
He's the Jay Leno of this podcast.
I am?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So you're upset because they stole your joke? Write another joke.
Have you seen this? Have you heard about this?
Have you tried these Doritos? They're delicious.
It's like all you want. We'll make more. Wow. Anyway, so what else have you seen?
That was it.
Oh.
I don't watch movies.
Yee.
Yeah, sorry.
There's some Corman films I can recommend, because there's a couple of those original New World films that are just so good.
Yeah.
The Raven?
No, that's AIP. That's,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I knew that.
Yeah. No, yes. This is really esoteric. He started his own company, and the first couple were like, wow. Battle Beyond the Stars and that.
And that's on there. I got to watch that. There's a couple like Pam Grier prison.
What's it under? Like, what's the category it'll be under?
I don't know. Are you just going to search for Roger Corman? Battle Beyond the Stars was made to respond to Star Wars. Right. And the interesting thing about that is James Cameron was the production designer on a shoestring, and John Sayles wrote it.
Yeah.
And it's an homage to The Magnificent Seven.
I'm going to watch it.
The Magnificent Seven in space.
Right.
Cool.
And just rips off Star Wars, but, you know, whatever. Did you ever see Star Crash, by the way?
No.
That movie's awesome. Totally rips off Star Wars. I don't remember the name of the
girl. I was surprised when that came out on Blu-ray, but that was part of that Corman reissue
program. Yeah, yeah.
Just pretend I'm not even here.
All right, let's talk other movies.
Your favorite movies.
Everybody's had a turn talking about their
quantitatively proven favorite movies that are defendable.
I can never change this answer.
They are without a question. Yeah. You can defend them.
Yeah, I can never go back and change these responses.
But looking at your picks, I don't think there's anything that's...
Oh, no.
I'm not embarrassed about any of them, but it's the kind of thing where a year from now, I may be really in love with something else, and, you know, who knows.
But once I looked at your list and saw the one film I hadn't seen...
Yes.
Was it starring me, Jack Nicholson? Yes, it was. You're embarrassing me. My hands are beginning to smoke. It was called Man Trouble.
Oh, my God. Yeah. That's obscure.
That's how I do, podcast.
So now we have a choice. The poster for Man Trouble or the poster for...
Don't limit us.
The Mask.
Or just Mask with Rocky Dennis.
So... I guess I'm going to – my number one movie is my number one movie, and then the other four I'm just kind of going to go chronologically, because I don't have like a third favorite movie. Oh. I really don't.
After all the time I spent ranking mine
in terms of the approximate
amount of pleasure that they give me, Mark Ahn gave me a lesson in football metrics that I still don't understand, but he thought it would help me, and he has beautiful feet.
For real, though, like, you're not going to rank your movies?
No.
That's such a pussy. Come on. Because it's like – that's what we've all done, except Erica.
No, I don't think that's true at all.
You know, Patrick.
The other podcasts weren't ranked?
Some of them were, but not all.
Doug, peer group pressure. You know, Patrick, everyone's ranking them.
Okay.
You're not cool if you don't rank them.
Okay, then these are ranked, but they're also surprisingly in chronological order.
What a coincidence.
What is so lame. I don't even know why I agree to do this podcast. Shit is shit.
My number five... movie is from 1939, and it is The Wizard of Oz.
It is not starring me.
We'll get to
you. Damn it!
Now wait, is that your Wicked Witch of the West?
That is my flying monkey!
At this point, I'd like to pause and wonder how many children have been scarred by the flying monkeys in that film.
Yeah.
Because I've always held The Wicked Witch up as something that's really scary in a children's film, but talking to 25 years worth of students, it's those monkeys.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's funny. When I first saw the movie, because the movie, it's long, and I think as a young kid, you'd watch, obviously, from the start, and I would never get to the end. Really? I would get to, like, because it's, you know, you get tired or you go to sleep because it's like you put it on, you have to go to bed, you have a bedtime. It was much later, you know, after I'd seen it maybe the beginning three or four times where I finally saw the end. And even now, the end is almost feels like a separate movie. I know that's such a weird, subjective, personal thing, but it feels like a separate thing because I know the beginning so well. And honestly, and this is well known amongst us and the podcast listeners, I hate puppets and I hate things that are weird and the Uncanny Valley. even going to Oz is such a mind fuck for me that is scary enough. Like when the Lollipop Guild comes out and there's nothing. Like, I know they're supposed to be inviting. Like, now I'm in my wizened age. They're inviting her. They're welcoming her to this fantasy land.
But I can really see how you can interpret that scene where they slowly emerge from the shrubbery.
Oh,
they're sort of bent over and singing, that it can be...
They're engulfing her. They're surrounding her. She can't escape.
They come up to her and say, have you ever heard of David Lynch?
They look a little bit like Garbage Pail Kids, actually.
Shut your face.
And they're like, hello, we are the Garbage Pail Kids. We were hiding in these bushes to frighten you.
And why are the Garbage Pail Kids / Munchkins, why do they sound like a particular actor from the state?
Ask Doug. They call him on the phone almost every day.
Every day. Hello, Doug. I heard you watched the Garbage Pail Kids movie.
And was your bunkmate Jesus Christ?
The Wizard. Go ahead. No, The Wizard of Oz. It's just the kind of movie that, like, I think it's a perfect movie. I think so much of what I love in all movies sort of starts with The Wizard of Oz, and I know that's not entirely true because even like seeing Hugo when they show clips of like the George Méliès stuff, it's like, oh, that's where it actually starts. But The Wizard of Oz was obviously the introduction to it for me.
Big scale, too.
Right. And if nothing else, it's. I guess there's two movies on my list that are sort of from my childhood, but this one much more so than my other choice. And, you know, this was the first movie that was like a special event. They would show it on TV once a year, and you made it a point.
When was it that showed it? Was it always a holiday?
I should have looked this up. It was always at a certain point of year because one year we took all of Jan's mother's home movies and had them transferred to video for her as a Christmas present. And in one of the videos, it's 1962 in Kansas, ironically, and they're watching it on a black and white TV. And because the home movie film is color, of course. And it occurred to me that, A, not only wasn't Wizard of Oz a huge success when it was first released, which I'm beginning to think is a mark of a superior film. If it's really great, it's not a success.
It's the slow burn towards appreciation.
I'm thinking of Blade Runner. I'm thinking of Synecdoche, New York. I mean, mind-blowing films don't do well the first time out. And then they keep re-releasing it about every 7 years like Disney
did. It's a Wonderful Life. Hello, yeah. I'm right here.
That was not a success.
Thank you. I'm just using a movie that I know.
I thought you were challenging me.
No, I would never
challenge me. And you know, part of it is they released that in the summer, which, who's the marketing
genius? No, it's Wonderful Life?
Yeah.
No, it was released in December.
Are you sure?
Yeah, they released it right before. They were supposed to come out. I mentioned this briefly. It was supposed to come out. Patrick just fell asleep. It was supposed to come out in 1947. They pushed it to 46 to be in consideration for the Oscars.
Yeah, I might be confusing it. There's another famous Christmas movie that came out in the summer.
Surviving Christmas, you're thinking.
Christmas with the Cranks, I believe. Four Christmases?
All kidding aside, I think it's either A Christmas Story or A Miracle on 34th Street. I'd have to look it up. But the film really becomes beloved when they put it on TV. And I think now, you know, TBS shows it every week, and they show it back to back, so the minute it's over, it starts up again.
Right.
And it was so special. Just like those Christmas specials, like How the Grinch Stole Christmas, one time only.
Right.
If you miss it, you're screwed for a year.
And at a very young age, I sort of understood that, because even when we got a VCR... And we were sort of late adopters on the VCR. 1 year when it ran on, I think CBS is the network that used to run it when I was a kid.
Yeah.
My family taped it. And I really felt like that was cheating. And I didn't ever want to watch the VHS copy because my feeling was, no, you have to wait until next year when it comes on TV again.
So you were crazy even at a very young age.
Listen, it starts young. A couple weeks ago when we did JB's Favorite Movies show... He mentioned a book, The Making of The Wizard of Oz by Al Jean Harmitz.
Yes.
And said it was the best making of book he'd ever read. And I said, oh, I'd really like to read that. And then a few days or weeks later, he surprised me with this gift. He had found a copy of it and gave it to me as a gift. And I appreciated that. Thank you. I read the book, and the book has only served to make me appreciate the film 10 times more. the way that, like, when I watch that 4-hour Blade Runner making of documentary, like, that's really when you become convinced, like, this is one of the best movies ever made. The Wizard of Oz book, and kind of a theme on these favorite movies podcasts, we've talked a little bit about how some of these great movies happen by accident.
Yes.
And man, did I don't know how The Wizard of Oz ever came together the way that it did, because it had just endless screenwriters, it had 4 directors, it had cast members replaced.
Burned skin, right, from like the makeup tests and stuff.
Well,
and
Margaret Hamilton got lit on fire, but Buddy Ebsen was inhaling aluminum dust into his lungs and had to be hospitalized.
And that would have been a very different film with Buddy Ebsen as the Tin Woodman, because the one story from the book. And I'm so glad when I was at your house the other day and you said you were almost finished with it.
I have now finished it.
And you told me that you thought it was great.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I recommended the book, I hadn't read it in like 20 years. And I was glad that I wasn't just like imagining it.
No, it's unbelievable.
Most of what I know about the film is from that book.
It's out of print too, right?
That's yeah.
So it's an extra special gift.
It is.
Well, you said I found it. I found it on Amazon, where you can find everything, including skincare products.
But the rare books section of Amazon.
No, you had predicted this in a comment on something, and you said it's probably available reasonably, and it is, and I recommend the book. One of my favorite stories in the book is Jack Haley, who was the
discovered a comet,
the replacement.
Who was the replacement, Tin Woodman, was talking to the other actors about the voice he chose for the Tin Woodsman. And he said, when I sit down to tell my kids a story, I adopt this voice that's kind of breathless. And you're reading this in a book, and you can hear, maybe because you've seen the film 10 times, that what an amazing choice that was, and what a great thing that was for him to do, because that's really something he brings to it that's different than the other two.
Yeah.
And the other thing I like about the book is all the stuff about Burt Lahr and how miserable he was and how they were always trying to upstage Judy Garland and the director was screaming. When they would go down the yellow brick road, they were like, the director would scream, "You're blocking her." Because they were old vaudevillians who were going to...
It's such a I recommend the book to anybody, honestly, even if you don't love The Wizard of Oz. If you have any interest in...
I want to borrow it.
The way that movies used to be made, because not only is it incredibly detailed about the making of The Wizard of Oz, but it's also this great snapshot of the way that movies were made under the studio system, and it's this great picture of how movies were made specifically at MGM, which had this reputation.
And she wrote it at a time when... almost all the cast were still alive and actually got to interview them, because the book came out a while ago. And I love how she makes the point that Burt Lahr could never appear in a movie as a real person, because he just had so much energy from the stage. He was grotesque. It was like you couldn't watch him on the screen. And yet when he played this lion, it was acceptable.
Right. I love the movie. I think it's... I like how simple sort of the messages are, but I think there's actually a lot for an adult to take away from the movie. I love the way that it's scary in that way, and it's the thing that you're always responding to, that there used to be, you know, films that were made for general audiences, even specifically kids, that weren't afraid to be, like, a little bit scary in that weird way that... terrifies you.
But yeah, not it's not
but
scary.
But it sticks with you for your entire life.
It's not scary in a way that's like showing a child being kidnapped.
Exactly,
or a
not
gun.
At all.
It's scary in a way that's more kind of, you can't put your finger on it.
Right.
And when you're watching a person hang themselves, like I've seen in Wizard of Oz, in
that's
the one
an
scene
urban legend.
Where they walk. Oh, no, I've seen
urban
it.
Legend.
No, I've seen it with my urban own two legend. Eyes, and that's a pleonasm.
Disney was the master of this, because Disney knew that if the good sunny stuff was going to be good and sunny, that you had to have something to play it off against. So there's the donkey transformation in Pinocchio, which I think Joe Dante pointed
out.
Which
I think I still can't watch, by the way.
Is one of the best Wolfman transformations in the history of film. It's terrifying.
Yeah, I still can't watch that.
Why have we never named a band Donkey Transformation? That's the perfect punk ska band.
It's interesting, because as I go through and talk about each of my movies, there's sort of a theme that runs through all of them, and it sort of obviously starts with The Wizard of Oz. I think it's just one of the best, if not the best, fantasy movie ever made.
What I always took away from it, too, and this is, again, my own personal, what I take from it, I know we talked briefly about how it's a fantasy and how she goes to this wonderful world where it's all Technicolor. And to get back home, it's to go back to a pretty miserable Dust Bowl black and white, not even black and white, sepia tone.
Which is a point that John Waters has made ad nauseum, that when he was growing up, he could not figure out
why she
wanted to go back.
Right.
Oz is wonderful, and you have these delightful, entertaining friends.
And she is the victor, and she's killed off, and everyone's happy that she's there, and everyone loves her, and she goes back, and it's like, you know, the next day, even though she's bedridden because she fell off and hit her head, she's got to work the next day. They've got to put food on their family. She needs to get back in the field, and I don't know. It was always really kind of like, I didn't like the ending in that respect.
And we sometimes forget it's a musical, that it's one of the best MGM musicals ever made. And another thing in that book I remember is she interviewed Harold Arlen and Yip Harburg, who wrote the score.
Yeah.
And
they don't name him like that anymore.
No, they definitely don't. These guys all wore suits to work. I mean, right. It's crazy.
That he, well, interestingly enough, to show you how smart studios are, Over the Rainbow was out for a while. In fact, You can still see the edit where they tried to take it out. But the lyricist said that Dorothy was a little girl and would have little girl concepts and ideas, and that maybe there's something Over the Rainbow. He wanted to keep it simple. And I remember he was very critical of the song Where Is Love from Oliver, because he says Oliver is expressing words and ideas that children don't have.
Yeah.
And I thought that, too, was some measure of the care that was taken with the film.
Do you like the movie at all, or has your opinion been affected by it because of like the whole L. Frank Baum, like the story and the populist era, you know, from the 1800s with the silver standard and all that stuff? Or
no.
I know the social studies teachers at my school bounce that off the kids.
I think it's a way to kind of relate. Yeah,
has it been established that that's what he was doing?
Well, in the
do
book,
you want to elaborate what.
In the,
so that people know what you're
sure,
talking
about. Sure, yeah, and I don't really know the whole story. I just remember, again, from like a social studies class, I think in college, because I'm not smart, that a teacher had told me that it's from Williams Jennings, how do you say his name? Williams Jennings Bryant?
William Jennings Bryant.
William Jennings Bryant.
Wanted us on the gold standard or off the gold standard?
It wasn't gold. It was he wanted us on the silver standard.
Okay.
No, I take it back. I think it was, she was wearing silver shoes on the gold trail. And they changed, obviously, to Ruby. Again, I Wikipedia this, it's going to be much more interesting than
the book.
My explanation.
In the book, it's silver slippers.
Yes.
And William Jennings Bryant is the prosecuting attorney, is the real guy who the prosecuting attorney in Inherit the Wind is based on. Matthew Harrison Brady.
And so, yeah, so she's walking, like, it's this metaphor where she's wearing silver shoes, and she's walking on the gold standard, and it's like, I think he wanted silver to be...
That it's a political allegory.
Absolutely, right. So, and they changed it for the movie to Ruby Slippers. I think it's just purely a visual aesthetic thing.
Yeah, I think so.
And I don't know if they're still there. There was a period of time where Debbie Reynolds owned one pair of the Ruby Slippers, because Debbie Reynolds had a casino in Vegas, just a little tiny mom-and-pop casino that had a memorabilia museum attached to it that was all of her stuff. She has since auctioned it off. Hmm. She's out of the casino business. But obviously, whenever there's a prop in a major studio film, they make more than one of them.
Right.
Otherwise, it would be a disaster. One of the other pairs of Ruby Slippers is on display when you're snaking through the line of the great movie ride at Disney.
Hmm. I just heard there was a pair in the Smithsonian also, which may not be true, but I grew up hearing that story that, like, the Ruby Slippers are there, and it made me think that the Smithsonian was a place I would want to go, because I like the Wizard of Oz, and the slippers are there.
You love slippers. You love women's feet,
is basically what it comes down to.
Footwear
and shoes.
It would be hard to point fetishist to an any more iconic prop from a movie.
Yeah.
It's pretty much the Ruby Slippers
and
the Rosebud Sled.
Right. Yeah. But I would argue that more people have seen The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, hands down.
Which, again, came out in 1939, which is sort of widely acknowledged to be the best year for movies ever.
What else came out that year? Because I know it's
Gone with the Wind, because Victor Fleming directed both of them.
Makes sense.
Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Totally normal things for a guy to do. Direct Gone with the Wind.
Well, again,
totally
he was
normal.
One of four directors on The Wizard of Oz, too, but he did the majority of it.
Stagecoach, if you look up 1939,
Wuthering Heights,
it's just...
Yeah. Well, one Best Picture, because the Oscars Oscars are the thing that I look to see what is the best movie of the year.
And to that I reply, Oscar Schmeister.
Next movie.
Okay. My number
Unless you want to talk about
movie,
Wizard of Oz some more.
As well as the next movie chronologically, is a movie that I did not grow up with at all, and it is Beauty and the Beast, not the Disney cartoon.
B.R. what?
The 1946 French film La Belle et la Bête, directed by Jean Cocteau. And this is actually a movie that I came to much later in life. I maybe read an essay on it, and I wanted to seek it out. And watching it, it was like, oh, this is everything, again, that I like in a movie done before all these other movies did it. And this is The Wizard of Oz, but for a much more adult audience. Like, it has sort of the weird childhood fantasy stuff of The Wizard of Oz, but it's a very kind of dark movie at times. It's funny, it's scary, it has all this stuff going on. And again, I think what I respond to more than anything is just sort of the beauty of it and the creativity, but also the sense of humor. The end of that movie, I think, is so great and so sort of subversive for 1946. And again, maybe it's because it was made by the French that they could do these kinds of things. But I just think it's such an amazing movie. It's a movie that you know, it has sort of a child's... it looks at the world sort of the way that a child might, or it speaks to a child, but it has an adult's understanding of how life works. Does that make sense?
It begins with this little written prologue,
right,
that talks to us about what children believe, mm-hmm, in a fairy tale. So clearly it's being pitched to adults, because there were some things in the film I found very disturbing, mm-hmm, and almost Lynchian. And I think very small children would be very frightened by this, yeah, film. I found the special effects really charming.
So great.
And in a couple cases, because of course I was watching it on DVD, I had to run it back and figure out how they did it, yeah, which if you're watching in a theater, you...
when she comes through that wall?
Yeah,
that's awesome. That's unbelievable. And I feel like the Disney cartoon, which while I think that's great and is one of my favorite of sort of the Disney animated movies, certainly of like the second wave, I think it's undercut the impact of the French film a little bit, because you see a lot of the things, and maybe these were in the story, I never read the original fairy tale, but sort of the candlesticks that move and have faces or whatever. And you're used to seeing it in the cartoon. Like, I saw the cartoon first, and so when I saw it in the movie, I was like, oh, well, that's where they got it and blah, blah, blah. But if the cartoon never existed, those things would be really scary and kind of disturbing. But they're not, because immediately you're just conjuring up the animated version of
that.
The
faces in the fireplace,
Chip, yeah,
are very disturbing. And obviously I saw the Disney version first, because I only saw this last weekend in anticipation of this podcast. And one of my reactions throughout the film is just how much Disney stole from, yeah, the French version.
Yeah.
But also, curiously enough, it gave you some insight into how it had been Disney-fied, because in the French version, she has two awful sisters, and I could just see Disney saying, oh, well, we've done that. We did that in Cinderella.
Right.
We don't need that.
Right.
That the one lover becomes Gaston,
right,
and becomes even more obnoxious,
right,
and then the ne'er-do-well brother becomes that little snot-nosed sidekick,
right,
midget guy.
Smee.
Yeah, basically, yeah, the Smee character.
Right.
But... you're right that all of the menace has been ironed out, because these are cute cartoon characters and they sing. The arms holding the candles on the wall, those very disturbing faces in the fireplace. There are scenes in her room where half the time it's a very convincing mannequin that's a piece of furniture, and other times it's an actress wearing very heavy makeup that's been matched very well to the mannequin, and her head moves, and I'm in the uncanny valley.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, was it the first Beauty and the Beast
film? I believe so, yeah.
And there's been lots of different adaptations.
Your favorite being the Ron Beastly Perlman TV,
yeah,
show. Oh, Beastly.
Beastly.
The TV show.
No, the Beastly. Beastly is the best. It's the Bestly.
My wife.
When I say Beastly.
Beastly is Bestly.
I mean Bestly.
My wife. Doug from at this movie, and I say Beastly is Bestly. I give it 3 stars. Out of 4.
My wife.
You went with 4. That's the best part.
My wife saw it on
my wife.
My wife saw it on a plane and pronounced it unwatchable.
Beastly, I've never seen Beastly. And I remember the is it ABC? had Beauty and the Beast?
CBS.
It was a TV show that was very popular. And, there was quite a cult around
it. And I never had seen it except for it was on, I want to say, Sundays at like 6.
I don't know.
I feel like, and again, this is so, could be so wrong, but like, it was always on and I always had to change the channel very fast. Kind of like when I hear the MASH theme song come on at like 11:30 at night as I'm watching The Simpsons ends and MASH comes on. It's like, I run, or the Sanford and Son theme song, and I change the channel.
I believe it was one of those shows where things had to be explained to you during the opening credits, and the minute they got to "He lives in the sewers," right, I reached for the remote.
And Ron, of your fear of Chud. It's Linda Hamilton too, right?
Yes, it is. Yes.
So this is the first film version of Beauty and the Beast. But I know even they, Jean Cocteau took John. I'm calling him John.
John.
Jean Cocteau took liberties because in the book, I want to say it's not two sisters and a brother. It's two brothers or three brothers. It's, I mean, so they're always like doing little variations and whatever else. So I mean, to say that the Disney one is changing Jean Cocteau, it's like, well, you know.
I also thought the score was interesting because there are scenes, and I know the Criterion disc is a reconstruction, but I'm assuming they didn't monkey with the music. There are scenes where the music really seems to be at odds with what's going on the screen, and I wondered if that was deliberate. When the father is lost in the woods, and it's very foreboding and scary, the music is almost heroic. It's very... It's subtly disconcerting,
right,
and I'm wondering if they did that on purpose.
And again, Cocteau was not a filmmaker necessarily. He was like sort of this jack-of-all-trades artist, and it's amazing that he made this incredible movie. Not that it happened by accident, but it sort of did, that all these things worked together. I love that, you know, in the Disney version, the Beast is just sort of, well, he looks like a monster, but he's actually very gentle and misunderstood.
He's grouchy.
And this Beast isn't. This Beast kills. And
yeah,
there's that great, I mean, there's a scene very early on where he's trying to have a conversation and he's looking at the deer. Like, you're reminded, like, oh, he wants to kill that. Or the deer's already dead. It's like, oh, he killed the deer. And I just love the end. I love how sort of weird and cynical it is for this fairy tale from 1946, where, spoilers for the movie coming up, but again, everybody knows the story of Beauty and the Beast, where the Beast essentially dies and is transformed, and in this great touch, he's played by the same actor that plays the Beast and who plays the asshole friend of the brother. It's all the same guy, who was also the lover of Jean Cocteau.
Which I thought was a very clever twist, because once that happens, you realize he's been playing the Beast all along.
Right.
That's pretty cool.
Wait, did you say, just time out, did you say the lover of Jean Cocteau?
There are some men who are able to have
that's
sex.
That's what I'm saying. It's a man
men.
You're talking about.
Yeah, that's the thing. They have a pill now that
notice
you can take.
Notice he said
that
men are able. You've just never been able.
Listen, I don't have a
this
problem.
Guy,
unless, are they in love?
He puts the cock in Cocteau.
literally.
But I just, and I love the way that her, the Belle's face registers disappointment when her Prince Charming comes along and she's disappointed because A, he looks like this asshole, and B, she misses the Beast. And I just love that here's a movie that says, no, the Beast was the better guy. I love it.
I think that was actually a response a lot of people, like when, I think when it first screened, people were shouting like, no, bring back the
There's
Beast.
There's a famous story, I think it was Greta Garbo maybe, who was sitting at one of the first screenings and said like, where's my beautiful Beast?
And that's the triumph of the film, because
yeah,
by the end of the film, we really like him, and we can understand that being away from him, she realizes her true feelings.
You like me. You really like me.
That's the Beast's Oscar acceptance speech, I believe.
I give you the queen. You have made my globes golden.
If you ever watch it on a DVD or a recommendation, the special effects are very low-tech and very ingenious and clever. They're presented like magic tricks, and there's a scene where Belle is wearing this beautiful necklace, and her awful sister takes it, and it instantly becomes a bramble. And it's very easy to figure out how they did that. But the next shot is so amazing. She's holding the bramble necklace, and she drops it. And when it hits the ground, it becomes the beautiful necklace, and it's all one shot. And I ran it back, and I watched it, and I ran it back, and I watched it, and it took me forever. And I was like, oh, wait a minute, that's really clever. And if you do that, you can figure it out.
It's easy. It's the switch-o, change-o.
Oh, yeah, this little abracadabra, little presto.
After the podcast, I'll be explaining to these two gentlemen how they did it.
Did you guys both like the movie? Neither of you had seen it prior to this.
I had never seen it.
Did you like it?
Yes.
I liked it a lot. I
liked it fine.
I think the only problem
I like the Disney
was
version better.
I was watching it through the lens of why did Patrick pick this?
Sure.
Very quickly, though, I wanted to point out that as I'm watching the film, I'm watching the credits, of course, because I'm that guy, and the director of cinematography was Henri Alequin. And in the back of my mind, I thought, I've heard that name before, so later I looked him up. This was his sixth film. This was only his sixth film. It's pretty accomplished for that early in his career. 21 years later, he is the... it's not 21 years later. Boy, is my math bad. This is 46, right?
Yeah.
41 years later.
Oh.
That's much worse. Or better?
Longer? Shorter.
Wider.
It's a lot longer.
Oh, okay.
He bookends Thicker. His career. He was the DP on Wings of Desire.
Oh, wow.
Which is one of my favorite movies.
And not according to your list.
Yeah, your list didn't have Wings of Desire on it. I know, because I listened.
And
I listened.
In a lot of ways, very much.
Yeah. I can see that.
Very, you could see why Wim Wenders said, "Let's go
Let's
with
get the
old
guy
man."
I liked it. I was swept up in a lot of its charm. My wife loves anything French and anything black and white, which
this movie is both.
It's yeah, and it's I had never I felt like I'd never seen anything like it. Even though again, there's a lot of if you had seen the cartoon, there's a lot of similarities. But I liked it. Yeah, it was great.
My wife loved the shot of her running.
Yes.
And it's in slow motion,
yes.
And it's quite beautiful.
Yes.
I really liked all the stuff in the hallway that was done in reverse.
Yeah.
I thought that was very clever.
Such a cool movie. If you guys haven't seen it, please seek it out.
Yeah, there's a lot of, if nothing else to it, seems like there's a lot of ingenuity in terms of, like, the reverse and the slow mo. It's like maybe that stuff hadn't really been done
that stuff,
to effect before.
Like,
the Bell was also a crazy fox. And if nothing else, I've been thinking about this movie more than a lot of other movies I've seen lately. Okay. So I guess that has stuck with me. Again, I'm a slow burn kind of guy. I'm the first to admit it takes me a long time. I just got into Radiohead, if that helps you out.
I did see this movie later, but the first time I watched it, my immediate reaction was like, that's one of the best movies I've ever seen, and I just wanted to watch it over and over again.
I'm going to cut to the quick, because
please do.
I know at the during all the podcasts, you had talked about what you like to do is when you do a podcast with me or JB or Mark or whomever, you like to look at that group of movies that they've selected and kind of look at the person. And obviously your movies and more will come out in the podcast. Although these are the two most fantastical movies, but you are into the fantasy and kind of this leaving the regular world type of thing, which only makes me question what's so wrong about where we live right now. Are you not enjoying our company?
Let me talk about my next movie.
Oh, great.
From 1974, Doug's favorite. Here's something weird. On your podcast, I'm pretty sure I said I don't like musicals. And then I realized I picked two musicals as my favorite. But
This is it.
Right? And Singing in the Rain. Those are the three.
But wait, you like West Side Story. I mean, you could
I've never seen West Side Story.
You've never seen West Side Story?
No.
How could you claim to be a movie person and never have seen West Side Story?
I've been in West Side Story, but I've never seen the movie.
When you said that about musicals, it reminded me that I had done that column where I was suggesting movies.
Yeah.
And the musical list was the hardest because I love movies, but it's very hard to find musicals that aren't,
and there were just so many of
just leave it at that.
Right.
But
you could pick five and be done with it. Yeah.
So my next movie from 1974 is Phantom of the Paradise, written and directed by Brian De Palma,
one of Patrick's favorite directors.
He is, and
love Blow Up.
I guess.
Well, damn it, did it again.
Blow Up is the Michelangelo Antonioni film.
In the 90s. I really started watching a lot of Brian De Palma movies, and I got into like his...
Started with Snake Eyes.
This was pretty insane. This is why I was so jazzed to see Snake Eyes. It was a bit of a letdown. But I was in...
Raising Cain,
anyway? I kind of like Raising Cain. Listen, I got into his 80s stuff more than before I got into any of his 70s stuff, so I was like way into Body Double and Dress to Kill and Blowout, which could have been on this list because I love that movie a lot.
That was for a long time. As your friend from high school, that was your kind of like your an unorthodox favorite movie, yeah. like that no one really heard of, because you talked about it all the time, really annoyingly, ad nauseum.
So I loved Brian De Palma, and by chance, one day I was like flipping channels on cable in the 90s, and I flipped past like Encore, and I caught the last 10, 15 minutes of this movie, and everything about it grabbed me. The set design, the actors, the costume on who I would find out was the Phantom. The music in particular that played during the ending credits, Paul Williams did all the music, and he's a short, odd fellow. But there's a song called The Hell of It that it just grabbed me in every single way, and I was like, what the hell is this movie? I need to see this. And a credit comes on screen and says, written and directed by Brian De Palma. So it was this weird fluke where it was like, oh, here's this guy that I love and this thing that I just have to find out more about, and they just happen to intersect.
It's the perfect storm.
It was, and it took me a long time.
Which brings us to your second movie.
That's going to be the poster on the podcast.
But it took me a while to find it because it wasn't on DVD yet, and a lot of video stores didn't necessarily carry the VHS of Phantom of the Paradise, and it wasn't showing up a lot on cable, so I had to track it down, and then when I did, I watched it a whole bunch of times.
It was very hard to find for a while.
Yeah,
I remember that.
And luckily, Fox put it out on DVD in like the early 2000s. And I have watched it a lot. Last year, for my birthday, I was screening some movies for the gang, and Phantom of the Paradise was one of the movies. And it ended, and Doug was trying to wrap his head around why I liked it, and I
still am.
And I'm supposed to talk about it now on a podcast, and I don't even think I could give you a concrete answer, except to say that like everything.
Everything about it answers.
Speaks to me, just what I like.
Yeah.
I just like it. I like the crazy, over-the-top performances. I love the music. I love the way that it sort of pulls from Phantom of the Opera and Faust. And I love the way that it kind of is making fun of 70s pop culture. But I think it's still saying some sort of relevant things about the music industry, whether it's a comment on, you know, the sort of black songwriters of the 50s and 60s being ripped off by these white people who make a fortune selling their music. You know, not that that sort of thing still goes on today, but it kind of does.
The hairstyles and the clothes obviously date the film, but in terms of what the film is saying about the music industry, it's still tremendously contemporary.
Yeah.
And that makes me feel, and I don't want to sound... Well, it makes me feel like I don't get it. Like, I really don't. Everything you just said, like, you mentioned Faust, and I kind of know a little, not a lot. I'm not a genius. And I know a little bit about the music industry, and I know a little bit about Phantom of the Opera because I've seen the musical and, you know, I've seen actually one of the oldest Phantom of the Opera movies I actually really like. That's me being esoteric. but I can't put all those things, those components to me are so dissimilar, and I can't quite reconcile everything. And that's just me. And I'm not saying you never, and I know you know this, and obviously this is just for me for the podcast, for me to say to the podcast audience is like, you don't have to defend this choice to me. Obviously, we're best friends, and I don't.
You have to defend this choice to God. That's what you have to do.
You'll never have to, like, obviously these choices, and we've talked about this a lot over the past couple weeks, these are all very subjective. It's really hard to make a top 5 list, let alone a top 10 list, let alone a top 50 list.
Yeah.
And to really pare it down and break it down to all these very specific movies, it's hard to do. My thing, and something you actually said last week after we did our podcast, we pressed stop and we talked for a bit, and you had talked about your list, and you said, this is okay, we talk about
sure.
You said, like, I got my list. I fleshed out my list a long time ago just so I would have something that I could sink my teeth into and mm-hmm. whatever. And just like any list, a lot of the movies are not interchangeable, but could change.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I talked on my list, I said, well, Ferris Bueller could be Blues Brothers, or this could be that, or this, you know, represents war movies, or this represents the kind of movies that I respond to. And you had said what stuck with me was that you said, my favorite movie is my favorite movie. That's mm-hmm. like, it's number one. The other four are all excellent. That's obviously why you took the puss way out and didn't rank them.
Yeah.
But you said Phantom of the Paradise is probably not your second favorite movie of all time. But of your top five, if anywhere, like, it would never leave your top five list. But the other ones could, which means the one that might be number two in a theoretical world could not be there tomorrow.
Yeah.
But Phantom of the Paradise, which might be five, could be there tomorrow. I thought that was very interesting.
It just makes me so happy to watch it, and I love all the stuff that De Palma does with the camera. I love how crazy over the top William Finley is, and how crazy over the top Garrett Graham is, and then Jessica Harper is in a different movie altogether. She's playing it very serious. She's sort of this sad character who's a sellout.
Her dance scene is pretty.
And of course, she does the Jessica Harper dance. I love the music so much. And a couple of months ago, we did a whole column on our favorite soundtracks, and I got all caught up trying to write about Michael Giacchino, and I completely forgot to even mention the fact that Phantom of the Paradise is my favorite.
It might just soundtrack have a whole separate column, though. Right. I mean, you don't want to like shoehorn that into a column with all share with the rest of us.
I was very fortunate a couple years ago at the Music Box Massacre. They actually screened like a brand new print of this movie, and it was at like 2 a.m, so not everybody was awake for it.
I slept through it.
Yeah. But I was happy to see it on the big screen because I never had.
There's a song in the score is really amazing from the cleverness of having the same band sort of morph into darker and darker bands. They're the Juicy Fruits, and then they become the Beach Bums.
They kind of start as the like a 50s group, and then they become the Beach Boys, and by the end they're David Bowie and Alice like Cooper and
Undertaker or something. But there's one song in the show called Old Souls.
Yes.
That sounds a lot like a Carpenter song because William's big claim to fame is he wrote We've Only Just Begun for the Carpenters. But ever since I first saw Phantom of the Paradise for the first time, there is a song in the show. I bet Patrick can guess what it is. And it sticks in my head, and I find it so haunting and so affecting, and every time I see the movie, it stays in my head for a couple weeks, and I can't get it out. The Faust theme.
Okay.
Where the...
The one that he's playing throughout, or I don't know which one you mean.
I'm not going to attempt to sing.
Okay.
I was not myself last night.
One that he's writing for the cantata the whole time.
Right, and the chorus is... And I actually listened to this today on YouTube, where it's very hard to make out the actual words. I thought he was saying bitter style.
Okay.
But that's not what he's singing. Okay. And the thing that sticks in my head and I can't get out is he's sort of longing for this love that he's never going to have. And he sings, dream a bit of style. We dream a bunch of friends. Dream each other's smile. And dream it never ends. And that's very affecting. And that gets through my hard outer shell.
And I'm just asking, just... You know, just, qualitatively, do you like this movie? Did you like it before? Do you like it more now? Do you appreciate it? What's your take on the movie?
I love this movie. This movie is everything I like thrown into a blender and hit to frappe, which a lot of Brian De Palma movies are.
Yeah.
But I don't think that was my original reaction. I think the first time I saw it, I thought it was a hot mess.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of things going on.
And that's what I was going to say when you said like that you missed some of these things when you watched it. And that's totally understandable because you have to remember, I've seen it a bunch of times. I can process it. Because the first time you see it, I mean, it just washes over you in this, like, what is this thing that I'm watching?
Parts of it are a cartoon. Parts of it are a horror movie. Parts of it are a rock opera. And then there's Jessica Harper, who seems to be in an Ingmar Bergman film. I mean, it's quite odd.
Yeah.
But...
Well, and again, I said this before, it takes a while for things to sink in with me in terms of like, why there are some visceral reactions that I have to movies and, but certain things that, especially the stuff that I've come to appreciate, and that's the appreciation is obviously the stuff you also kind of over time come to love.
Yeah.
I've only seen this once. I think also there's no pressure to watch something in a group in your basement, but there is kind of a weird thing as opposed to me discovering this on my own or it's kind of like, now I'm going to present to you this knowing that it's like, Patrick's like one of his favorite movies ever. And I really had I knew nothing about it, and I watched it, and it's batshit crazy. It is all over the place, and I think you and John probably have more similar sensibilities in movies than I do for sure. And it doesn't speak to me, which is not to say that I won't again grow to appreciate it and all those types of things. I just don't quite understand everything. I'm the first to admit it.
And that's what I was going to say. As you and I are, I think there's a point where we diverge a lot in terms of the kinds of things that we can sometimes respond to. And I don't think this will ever be a movie for you. You know what I mean?
No, I prefer football in the groin.
Exactly.
Speaking to you, I wanted to bring this up.
Okay.
You had, most famously, I think, on the Erica Top 5.
Yes.
You sort of look at the Top 5 and form some sort of psychoanalytic without portfolio picture of the person who chose the film.
Sure.
And thinking about your five and watching Beauty and the Beast this weekend, I wondered if a part of Phantom of the Paradise and a part of Beauty and the Beast that appeals to you is that, and I'm just spitballing here. Tell me if I'm all wet.
Okay.
Suddenly I'm in a 40s movie. Let me know if I'm all wet. And I'll call a cab and I'll jerk myself a soda.
That went a very different way.
My favorite line in Bugsy.
You have a favorite line in Bugsy?
That's the big reveal of the night here, folks.
Hey, James Toback, what's not to like?
I'll tell you what's not to like about James Toback.
Fingers.
Is it Bugsy?
It starts with Harvard Man. And it could pretty much fucking end with Harvard Man too.
Oh, I completely forgot. I'm on board with young James Toback of The Gambler.
Speaking of, I feel like I have maybe also not given Harvard Man a fair chance.
I think you did.
I don't know who we gave it to. If you are out there and you have my Harvard Man, if you could send it back so I can watch it again, I would be very appreciative. Carry on, John.
Looking at Phantom of the Paradise and especially looking at Beauty and the Beast, it made me wonder if there have been times in your life where you have felt...
This could be very interesting.
That people were interacting with you or acting around you or treating you or whatever you want to say that you had something inside of you that people couldn't see and that you wished that they would respond to what's inside rather than what's outside, because that's clearly a theme in Beauty and the Beast, but it's also a theme of Phantom of the Paradise, where this genius composer is slowly, you know, sort of taken apart, and other people are getting credit for his work. Do you think there's anything to that?
There could be. It would require me to really examine myself, and I'm not willing to do that. I won't like what I find.
I don't know if that's a question, in all seriousness, you could answer for yourself because you are very modest, and I don't think you would say if there was something, because what you're implying is like there's a beautiful artist inside Patrick, which I believe, no, I'm serious, like I believe that, but I don't think he would say that on
maybe
a public podcast.
There's a beautiful woman inside of me, and I wish people would see that.
No, there's a beautiful woman inside of Ryan O'Neill. but that gets in my way of the reality that... You were popular in high school, and it's not as if you were this...
Prom King, hello.
Oh, were you?
Whatever. We're talking about my favorite movies.
That it wasn't those. Like you were reviled, and you were hiding this thing.
No.
And it might just be that there have been times in everybody's life where they felt that way, that there's something inside of them that other people can't see.
I think when you look at all
I feel like complete opposite. I'm just like, everything's what you see is what you get.
I think there's a definite sort of through line to all of my favorite movies. It, just in terms of if you said, like, if you showed somebody the list and they had seen all those movies, they could kind of figure out the kind of person that likes all those, you know?
And I have a theory about Back to the Future, but we'll...
No, but everybody knows that.
Spoilers!
We'll get to that.
Marty McFly dies.
I don't think that's a spoiler for anything. My next movie from 1993 is Matinee, directed by Joe Dante. And I've talked before on the podcast about how Joe Dante is one of, if not my favorite, directors. This, I think, is definitely hands down his best movie. I think it's the culmination of everything. There you're supposed to say culmination. Of everything that
he... Varsity Blues. Varsity Blues. American High.
Of everything that he sort of did in his career, I think this is his peak.
And it's also, it's not just the culmination, but it's everything that could be seen as his excess kept in check.
Right. Yeah definitely. I love what it has to say about movies. You know, this is the year of all these movies that are the love letter to cinema. I think Matinee does a better job of all of that. Again, it's about this relationship to fantasy. It's about, in the same way that Beauty and the Beast is, sort of, it takes sort of a child's... It looks at the world through a kid's eyes, but has a very adult understanding of the way that the world works. I love, you know, part of it is I just love the period. I love the late 50s and early 60s. I love those old kind of science fiction movies. Has a great, fun performance from John Goodman.
I was going to say he was an inspired choice to play a part,
William
clearly
Cashel,
based on William Cashel.
And it has maybe my favorite explanation or description of why we love specifically horror movies, but I think it applies to all movies. The movie takes place during the Cuban Missile Crisis. If you haven't seen it, it's on Netflix Instant. Please see it. It's so, so great. I don't necessarily want to spoil it, but some kids think that the world is ending. And John Goodman, through a series of events, I don't want to say, but John Goodman basically says those kids are going to be fine because they thought the world was ending, you know, and they realized it didn't. And that's how you feel at the end of a monster movie. Everything is scary. Everything's horrible, but the lights come up and you're okay. And he refers to their experience of thinking that the world was ending as he says, they'll be fine. They've seen the coming attractions. And I feel like that is the best, most concise description of why we love horror movies. But even all movies, that all movies are sort of just the coming attractions for what life has in store for all of us. And I just think it's so articulate and poetic and beautiful.
There's a wonderful scene that I used to show for about 10 years in film study class at the beginning of a unit on the horror film, where the teen hero of the film is walking down the street with the William Castle character, and John Goodman is spouting off on all these things. But at one point he pauses, and he creates this scene on the side of a building of the first caveman who drew something on the wall, and he stops and says, well, wait, people are coming to see this. Maybe we can make the mammoth a little bit bigger and make his teeth a little bit larger. And through animation we see this come true, and he's making this great analogy to horror films. And it's this wonderful scene that ends with a point of view camera going through the theater and Goodman narrating. You enter the cave, and the cave is the movie theater, and the drinking fountain's been booby-trapped, and the popcorn is fresh, and you get in the theater, and by that time Goodman is standing in the theater, and what is it he says at the end of the monologue?
I don't remember. I'm King Ralph.
It's like, here I am, do your worst, or something like that.
Right.
But very much this message that we want to constantly be reminded that we're alive.
I just love the way that it marries sort of real historical events with this fictional, crazy, giant mant movie, which is hilarious. And I just love what it has to say about why we love going to the movies.
I remember back in high school, you'd actually show me Mant clips, and I thought it was a real thing because I had not yet seen Matinee. And
Laserdisc used to just have Mant, all the pieces put together,
and we would watch
it. Doesn't
that.
Work as just the movie's very smart because the little clips you see on the screen in the back of the action are the best moments. Because when you try and just watch Mant sort of beginning to end, it's not nearly as funny.
But I just know we quoted that all the time, different lines from Mant.
Yeah.
And one of the only reasons to keep a Laserdisc player in your system is they've never ported over that special feature of just all the Mant footage by itself. I think I still have mine.
I'm pretty sure I still have mine as well.
Do you both still have your players?
Oh, yeah.
Holy moly.
Yeah.
I just recently...
Nerd alert!
I just recently plugged mine back into the system, but the oddest thing happens. I don't know if you've noticed this. We're now used to Blu-ray.
Oh, my gosh.
When I spin a Laserdisc, I'm like... This used to be the best thing.
It looks worse than VHS.
It looks fly-specced. Yeah, yeah, it looks... Yeah. We thought this was the...
Yeah, it was the best.
It's you got new eyes when Blu-ray was invented.
I don't know really what else to say about Matinee, except that I love it.
It's a great, charming... It's a small movie. It's
didn't make succinct. Much money.
It's one of those things, too. I think that for all the reasons you said you love it,
yeah.
It's also... And this is me... Speaking what I respond to, it still works on all these other levels that are just, it's a great little movie that has a great little story and wonderful performances. It's funny. It's quick. It's, you know, has sharp dialogue. It's great.
About 3 months after it came out, I went to the second Famous Monsters convention in Hollywood, and Joe Dante was one of the guests, and I got to speak to him briefly. Somewhere in my classroom, I have an autographed Matinee poster by him. And I just told him, because I had just seen it. It had just come out and went. And then I went to this convention, just how much I appreciated the fact that he made this movie.
Yeah.
Because it really spoke to me. And he said he couldn't believe how many people he was hearing that from.
Yeah.
That refrain, I feel like you made this movie just for me.
And that's what the movie makes you feel like, definitely. That it really speaks to you on a personal level, and it's kind of this weird little miracle that it even got made because Universal put it out and it was not particularly commercial, and it's amazing that it happened at all, so we're very fortunate that we have that movie.
And there's a great subplot where John Sayles and Dick Miller are hired by the director to protest the film, to drum up interest.
Right.
And the town hippies see this as a First Amendment issue. So they're going to be there to see the film because they support his freedom of speech. And then they cut to them like halfway through the film and it's like, this isn't very good.
Yeah. And but then again, they're the parents of
great
Sandra, and it's actually a little
machine.
Yeah, it's a tight little screenplay. Speaking of which, let's talk about my number one, the tightest of screenplays. It's no surprise to anybody who's listened to this podcast for 100 plus episodes that my favorite movie of all time is Back to the Future from 1985. Enough said.
I don't know what else there really is to say. It's a perfect movie. It's so great.
Yeah,
I don't necessarily know how it fits in. If you're talking the thematic,
yeah,
when you analyze us and look at us, it's like it seems to me almost a little bit detached or separate from the previous four in terms of...
I think there's definitely connections you can make. Not only sort of the sense of nostalgia, not only sort of the fantastic elements, but what's great about that movie and a lot of Robert Zemeckis' early movies, and I even think this is true of Forrest Gump, and Forrest Gump never got the credit for it, is that just,
you're saying Forrest Gump never got credit for being
just like Beauty and the Beast, that on the surface it's sort of this simple child's fairy tale, but it's actually saying some things that are kind of dark. I think Back to the Future is too, that there's another layer to all of these movies. I mean, Phantom of the Paradise, the darkness is pretty much on the surface, but that on the one level, it's just this very pleasant little story about a boy who goes back in time and gets his parents together and then goes back to the future and everything's fine. But it's saying some dark things, not only about the 50s, but about the 80s and selling out and what it meant to be a success in the 1980s. That when he comes back and we're supposed to be thrilled at how well everything has turned out, that his parents are now sort of the picture of Reagan America, and that Zemeckis actually felt like, no, that's not great. You know, it's Belle ending up with the douchebag Prince Charming at the end. Like, no, this actually isn't great, everyone, but everybody reads it as a happy ending.
Though? I mean, how does it not come across that that's a happy ending?
I think he just felt like by presenting George McFly as sort of this yuppie douche that people would sort of infer that, you know, I don't think he does it successfully enough that everybody could take that away. I only know that he does that because I've read interviews with him or heard him make comments about how that ending is sort of a critique on Reagan America in the 80s.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm not sure if I completely buy that in terms of, because it's, you look at the pre-flashback, yeah, they're losers, they're poor, they're
miserable.
Yeah, and Biff is like the boss who's an asshole, and he comes back and Biff's their servant, basically, and there's so much to like about the present, you know?
If that was his intention,
yeah,
I don't think that was conveyed to 95% of the audience. It's such a conventional happy ending,
yeah,
where everybody, he's a successful science fiction author because of the ruse that was played on him, and mm-hmm, his sister and his brother have jobs that aren't in the fast food industry.
I mean, say enough, right? Yeah, it's they have jobs. I don't think the sister had a job before. I know the brother worked at Burger King or something, yeah. But
I do know that there are sort of dark undercurrents to the film. I think one of my favorites being that the uncle who's always in prison, he just loves his playpen. We never take him out.
He cries whenever we take him out.
Michael J. Fox says, get used to it.
His bars, kid.
which is wonderful. And also the fact that the blues, the musicians are shown smoking grass.
Yeah.
Surreptitiously outside the high school dance.
You know, full admission, I saw this movie actually in the theater when it came out. My oldest sister took us, me and my older sister, to see this, and my memory is so weird because I remember being at the theater and it was summer and I was freezing. I was wearing like shorts and a t-shirt and the theater was so cold, and I loved this movie, but I was just like shaking the entire time watching this. And I think that scene with the bandmates all smoking pot in the car,
you have no idea what that was.
And I didn't, yeah, exactly, until I, because it probably was a gap from, like, I saw it a bunch of times when I was a kid. We had a VHS copy, the tattered old VHS copy. And then I got a DVD, or I watched it with you or something, and I was like, wait a minute! Mm-hmm. And there is a line where they kind of, like, you know, it's pretty obvious, like, hey, you, what do you call it, reefer heads or something like that, but it's, you don't even know, but it's, that's how well the movie works, because it works on that level, and also...
And it's so jarring in that same sequence where one of Biff's henchmen says, calls them something really spooks, racist and derogative, and you're just like, whoa, why didn't... Yeah. Pick that up when I was a kid, for
absolutely
sure.
You know? And I just said it out loud.
And the movie isn't necessarily filled with, like, these critiques of the 1950s.
Well,
it's
but
not...
the creepiness of kissing your mother.
Right.
The very real threat that Biff wants to rape her.
Yeah.
And the realization that your father was peeping.
Right.
That the original Meet Cute was based on the fact that he was a peeping Tom.
Right. Let's be honest, though. If your mom looked like Leah Thompson in Back to the Future, you'd make out with her, too.
It's just Calvin Klein. That, you know, it's like a dream.
This notion that if you were to go back in time and meet your parents in high school, that you just have this idea of your parents because that's who you grew up with. But to go back and see them in high school, just like, oh, my dad was a loser and my mom was... a little bit of a slut, you know?
And now, like, well, especially because it's telegraphed where she's like, I don't trust boys right, like that. The mom's all high and mighty in the present in 85. But so much of what you just said, too, about as a kid, you don't, like, you can enjoy this on a visceral, so, like, entertaining and just loud noises and fast cars.
It's a peppy film. Yeah. It does not waste our time.
And it's not a short film either, but
every time I watch, and I just saw it again at the patio a couple months ago, and I'm just amazed by the time we get to, like, the Enchantment Under the Sea dance, that, like, holy shit, we're here already?
Yeah.
Zippy.
It goes by so fast.
And then when you're older, I know even more recently, too, when you, like, when I was a kid, I never noticed that in the 1980s sequences that Hilldale is a slum. I never noticed it. Yeah. I never paid attention to the graffiti.
The movie theater's like showing a porn movie.
Yeah, I never, like, it never dawned on me. The only thing I thought was like, oh, it's kind of run down because the clock doesn't work, you know? And then you go back in the 50s and it's kind of like a Norman Rockwell painting or whatever, but it says so much about the 80s, and I think that's actually probably where Zemeckis could stand on that leg and say, I'm making a comment about the Reagan, you know, blah, blah, blah.
And in that way, on that page, it sort of resembles It's a Wonderful Life in terms of the way things could have gone.
Speaking of It's a Wonderful Life, isn't that a great movie?
I think one place in the film that you see the Reagan era thing, and I think the film has been criticized for this, although using logic you can sort of dispute it, that Michael J. Fox begins to play the guitar and Marvin Berry calls his cousin. Yeah. And says, listen to this. So the assumption is that Michael J. Fox started rock and roll.
Right.
But of course, from the time travel angle, he started rock and roll by playing the riffs that Chuck Berry had already played because someone had played him the phone call of Michael J. Fox playing the music that he had yet to write.
Right.
Don't overthink it.
I mean, clearly it's meant as a one-off joke.
Yeah.
Hey, Chuck, listen to this.
Right.
Well, they made a list. When they sat down to write the screenplay, they sort of made a list of things that they wanted Marty to do in the past. And one was invent the skateboard. And one was they wanted Marty to invent rock and roll. And again, going back to this Reagan thing, I don't know how much validation there is in the ending. But something you had said when we did a podcast on The Graduate where you talked about how that Ben Braddock's whole thing was to rebel against his parents and, you know, the generation gap. We're going to do something different, but that the way that it ends, he's going down the exact same path as they are. And there's a little bit, I think, of that in Back to the Future, and maybe that's what Zemeckis was going for. Not that Marty's going down the same path now as his parents, but if he's Mr. Rebel rock and roll, you know, he's sort of the disaffected teen at the beginning of the movie who just wants to play loud music and rebel. And then at the end, he's now just this privileged son of sellouts, you know, and what does that say for his future? I don't know.
Yeah.
But you'll have to find out in Back to the Futures 2 and 3.
I really...
on second thought.
I propose that we do a podcast on those two movies, and I'll save all my comments for the sequels then, because I've got some mind-boggling, mind-blowing revelations, not revelations, opinions or theories about those movies. But the first movie is a perfect little gem.
I think it's
standalone, even though, you know, it's funny, the original, I think you told me this, the original ending, and I don't remember that from my theater experience, didn't have a to be continued.
Yeah.
That was the addition of the VHS,
right.
That the movie ended, it was over.
Right. And a great ending and a great punchline. you know, great performances. Crispin Glover is so great. Christopher Lloyd is so great. Even Thomas Wilson as Biff is so great. Michael J. Fox is a great lead. Almost had Eric Stoltz. Another one of these movies that happened by accident. Nobody wanted to buy it. They had it written for several years.
Biff is one of the great movie villains.
Only in this movie, though, not the sequels. Go on.
And like a master's class in screenwriting. I just think it's amazing the way that things are set up in the first few frames of the movie that pay off all the way at the end.
And I'm not sure if we pointed this out on the podcast, but there are a series of books by the British Film Institute, little monographs about films. And about a year ago, 2 years ago, they published one on Back to the Future, which is where I found out that there was a scene that was left out of Back to the Future, which Spielberg later used in Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull.
Oh, the...
That the whole getting into the lead-lined refrigerator to escape an atomic blast was originally in Back to the Future, that that's how they were going to power the car or something. Obviously, it hit the curb, and Spielberg produced Back to the Future,
right?
And he remembered it, and he actually got their permission, and I think they're thanked at the end.
I heard one of the reasons was they didn't want to portray a person in a fridge for fear of inspiring...
Seriously?
Yeah, I actually read that, that they didn't want children to get inside refrigerators because there was a magical, mystical component to the fridge in the that scene in Back to the Future.
But I was very surprised when I read that because I thought that was one of the few things in Crystal Skull that worked at all.
Except for the way that it was shot, but because they telegraphed the fact that he's going to get in the refrigerator, and if they hadn't, it would have been a funny joke. Instead, it's, yeah, we know. We saw him think of that.
Right, that when...
It's aliens. It's aliens. Oh, it's aliens. Oh, okay.
If you take out the earlier shot and just have the refrigerator fall...
And then he falls out of
He falls out, and then we see Leadline.
Right. Funny joke.
Yeah.
Which speaks to, I think, Back to the Future, they, you know, I mentioned this to my brother, who's an engineer, and he's very... logical and analytical, and I mentioned Back to the Future is great. It's Patrick's favorite movie. We're doing this podcast on his favorite movies, blah, blah, blah. And my brother's first comment was like, well, you know, the Humvee flaws and blah, blah, blah. And he was doing that. He was being contentious and on purpose. We rib each other. But I love that the movie, you just have to accept so much of it, and you don't think about the flux capacitor, because all it is, it's like he fell and hit his head.
It's the thing that makes time travel
it's
possible.
It's a triangle on a piece of paper, and it makes it work. And don't overthink it. I remember, and not to diverge too much, but there's a whole Blues Brothers deleted scenes where Aykroyd, who wrote the film, wanted to explain how the car
does
magical things. And it's like, shut the fuck up. Like, the car is magic because the car is magic. It doesn't need to be parked next to a
generator.
Exactly.
It glows red. When The Blues Brothers was originally released, someone took Aykroyd's original screenplay and did a novelization.
Okay.
And famously, when Aykroyd turned in the script, Landis called it Apocalypse Blues because it was 375 pages long. And I'm sure this book is out of print, but I read it in 1980, and it was nuts, crazy.
Right, it's crazy.
Remember how they seek out Murph and the Magic Tones, and that's where most of them are?
Mm-hmm.
In the original screenplay, every band member was on a different job.
Oh, that sounds so great. I can't wait
to
see
that. And in the original screenplay, they destroy, there's model homes of a suburb. There's like 100 tract homes, and one of the band members is the Night Watchman. And they were, in the original script, they were going to destroy 100 houses.
And that's why The Blues Brothers is my favorite movie, everyone.
But seriously, the Back to the Future, like the time travel aspect of it, it does work, though, on a surface level. Like, I love that it's like all those little, like, lone pine to twin pine to lone pine.
Right.
And him watching himself and the letter and even the scene. Honestly, one of the scenes I used to not be crazy about was when Marty McFly convinces his father to ask his mom to the dance.
Yeah.
And it's a scene where the father admits he loves science fiction, he didn't know this about his dad, and he goes to his dad's house in the middle of the night, puts on his radiation suit, blasts Van Halen, and wakes him up. And I always thought that scene was just kind of like, blah. But you realize that it's set up, it pays off, and it delivers at the end when it's the book that it's
I always thought that scene was funny.
I'm admitting that I used to not be crazy about that scene, but now the movie, again, is a perfect little thing. And my wife had never seen it before, and she's in her late 20s, and I was flabbergasted. And we actually just watched it the other day, and she was, I mean, spellbound also. It was it's so great.
You can't overthink it, because I know for years and years in film study class, I used it as an example of you can't go back in time and see yourself leave, because then there's two of you, and that breaks the first law of physics. But then if you're thinking about it on that level, you're lost, and there's right. no way you're going
to
enjoy it.
And that's what all of Back to the Future 2 is about.
And I did want to bring up that that the two of you gentlemen, a long time ago, were in my film studies class, where I do this thing where I talk about technical terms and what we call everything. And for 25 years, I've been using the skateboard chase scene to explain the pan, the traveling shot, and the tracking shot. And I've done that so many times that that scene is wood burned in my brain. And if you just played the soundtrack to it, I could shout out, that's a pan, that's a traveling shot, that's tracking, tracking, traveling, tracking, traveling, tracking from inside the diner. That's very visually interesting. That's when Leah Thompson goes, it's Calvin Klein, yeah. It's like a tree.
That, a great score, too, by the way, which was something I think you talked about on another podcast, that the score doesn't date the movie because they used an orchestral score, even though it's 1985, and that was sort of not necessarily in vogue.
Which I'd like to give credit where credit is due. It was really Landis who was the first person to say, we're not going to go with jokey, we're not going to go with Mickey Mouse, we're not going to go with synthesizers. He insisted on an orchestral score for Animal House. And boy, talk about it being ahead of the curve. Is Back to the Future's Williams, right?
Alan Silvestri.
Oh, my bad.
Toga!
I tend to think that any movie with a recognizable short melody theme. Because
it's John Williams.
I think all of us right now could hum the Back to the Future theme.
And will, as we say goodbye.
And it was also in the, you used that little piece of music in the 100 episode movie on YouTube. If you haven't seen it already, check out our YouTube page, YouTube/FThisMovie, YouTube.com/FThisMovie, and look at Patrick's little compilation of all the movies we've effed.
And it ends with this one, so now we got to come up with something new. Shit.
And I'm sad that...
our 102 episodes.
I'm sad that the Back to the Future ride is has been dismantled.
Yeah, but, you know, there's going to be a Transformers ride in its place, so everything's right in the world.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if it's in place of that, but there is going to be a Transformers ride.
Well, they replaced it with The Simpsons.
Okay. Thank you guys very much for talking about my favorite movies with me. Hopefully it wasn't the worst.
Wait a minute. Before we part...
Yeah.
Is your love of Back to the Future at all based on a desire for you to go back and fix your past?
I don't know. I loved it at a young age, and I don't know if I wanted to fix my past then.
And that you would go back and ensure that you would be born a woman.
There's a woman inside me.
Please call me Mayor. Mayor Goldie Wilson. I like the sound of that. Love it.